It is hour number three of Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. At 2:20, Survivor Man Les Stroud joins the show in a mere minutes. I've got some disappointing news, but it's understandable because he is a wanted man. I'm Trey Elling. Bucky Godbolt is sitting across from me from one more segment. Isaiah Collier is behind the glass today, and unfortunately, just got an email that CDC would love to join me, but something popped up. Look, he's a guy who is in high demand, and absolutely, these things happen.
And Ricky called him and said, hey, you probably don't want to do this.
Look, I only asked Ricky one time about the organ-moving massages that he was talking about on Twitter. I was genuinely interested. As a guy who loves a good massage, he's talking about somebody out in Bastrop, I think, or somewhere else, who can literally shift your organs around. Mm-hmm. That really is supposed to help with back pain and other things like that. That's the only thing that I can think of. That or my admission that I stole his... Well, I didn't steal. I mean, I took it fair and square. But when I was a freshman at Texas, when the email thing was still fairly new, in the fall of 1996, I took rickywilliams@utexas.edu. I took that email address. I didn't realize you were supposed to use your own name at the time. I just thought it was cool to have Ricky,
that's
an email
probably
address
the one right
that says
there.
Ricky Williams' name.
Yeah, he probably wanted to have all of those, and you happened to take the one that he probably wanted the most. That may be where this is all coming from.
Maybe.
And the fact that you took his jersey that I gave to you and turned it into a pair of shorts. The Philadelphia Phillies deal.
Yeah, yeah.
I still not believing I gave you that deal.
Well, it's like an adult diaper hanging on my mantle along with the signed tequila that you gave me, the pink tequila.
Is that the one with Tony Dorsett or was that a Ricky one?
No, that was a Ricky one.
It was.
I also have a plaque that I guess Ricky pawned off to you. It was a Chevy Player of the Week award.
That's pretty cool, that plaque, by the way. What did you do with that?
That's on my mantle also. I've got a shrine to Ricky Williams in my living room.
Yeah, that was a Chevrolet Player of the Game.
The Philadelphia Phillies windbreaker turned adult diaper, the signed tequila, the Chevy Player of the Game, and the gift bag of CBD goods.
That, from Ricky's place, from Ricky's deal.
That Ricky sent to you and you gave to me.
He probably wouldn't be pleased to me that I gave you the Chevrolet Player of the Game.
Well,
I don't even know why he gave it to me.
I cherish these things.
Yeah, you
when
do.
Ricky talks about organ-shifting massages on Twitter, I'm his number one fan. I want to know more about these things. Ricky's just trying to enlighten us all.
Yeah, I mean,
and now I can't do that on Twitter.
I mean, at one time, it was like, so, Buck, you want this Doak Walker trophy thing to put it at your house? Or do you want to? He had all kinds of stuff he wanted to like give to me, and the story of him, of course, his freshman year giving me his letter sweater, his letter jacket, because Texas gives away letter jackets, not sweaters, not like when my dad gave me his North Carolina A&T letter sweater as a kid, and I cut the sleeves off of them. See you later. So, Ricky did give me that, and I said, no, you want this jacket. You're going to have 12 kids. That one of those kids is going to want that jacket. And to his older daughter, you know, she has that now. Marley has it. Marley Williams has Ricky's jacket because I held on to it and did not keep that.
Now, that's really cool. That is a really cool gift to give back.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want that. I mean, what am I going to do with your letter jacket, dude?
Do you think he's ever going to want his Chevy Player of the Week award back?
If he keeps having kids, he may want that back too.
Well, I'll be happy to give it back if it means going to one of Ricky Williams' kids.
No, I'm going to get that set up for you. I'll get that done for you, Trey.
I appreciate that. I actually have some good news. Looks like CDC, his time was not occupied for as long as they were thinking. He's going to be joining us in just a couple of minutes.
All right. Bye, y'all.
So, Bucky, I greatly appreciate the
time today.
Hey, real quick, wanted to let you know that Texas baseball, we now know when and who they will be playing in their very first game in Omaha at the College World Series. It happens Sunday night at 6 o'clock, 5:45 pregame with Craig Way and Roger Wallace. The opponent, Mississippi State. They won the third game against Notre Dame last night. And so it'll be Mississippi State and Texas, a rematch of the first game of the season for both teams, one that Mississippi State won up in Arlington. And this Texas baseball team has been resilient for much of the year. I'd like to think that they will be very focused on avenging one of those early season losses to the Mississippi State Bulldogs. And congratulations to amateur college athletes here in the state. Greg Abbott, the governor, officially signed a law yesterday that goes into effect on January 1st, allowing college athletes in the state of Texas to profit off of name, image, and likeness. Texas becomes the 17th state to put a law on the books, and actually the 6th whose law kicks in on July 1st. I think that is a big detail in this story, is that Texas is at the front of the pack in terms of those states that will allow its college athletes to profit off of name, image, and likeness. That benefits every college athlete in this state, certainly here at Texas as well. We are a member of the Haves. I'm not trying to say that arrogantly. It's just a matter of fact. Texas is about as financially well off as any program in the country. When you take the entire scope of athletics, that's certainly the case. Specifically in football as well, even though Texas football has been down more than up over the last decade, we're still in that group of people who, or that group of teams, that group of colleges who makes a lot more money than most anybody else. So let's keep an eye on what that turns into for athletes come July 1st. We've also asked what endorsement makes the sense, makes sense for a lot of athletes, past and present, too. We talked about Ricky Williams with CDC, said Major Applewhite. He could be advertising the fresh produce at HEB. There are plenty of great options out there. That's neither here nor there, though. Let's go to the Vaqueros Hotline now and welcome a guy who is, in my opinion, the best athletics director in all of college sports. He is Chris Del Conte of the University of Texas. Nice enough to join us for a few minutes. Chris, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me on. You doing all right?
Doing well, Chris. Thank you. I don't want to make any assumptions, but the successes achieved by your athletics department this school year, hell, this semester, is more than some ADs see in a career. The nerds at Stanford have done the math, and it looks like Texas is about to earn our first ever President's Cup, and we may not even be done yet, depending on how the baseball team does in Omaha starting this weekend. I don't want to make any assumptions, but is this the best your teams have ever done in a single year? And what does it mean to you personally?
Well, it just means our student athletes, our coaches are living up to the expectations of the Longhorn Nation, right? You come to the University of Texas because you can win championships. A lot of schools talk about it, but we can actually do it. And to have 13 of our teams finish, not only win conference championships, but we have a significant amount of our teams in the top five, and we have three national championships. So it just tells you that this is the power and breadth of the University of Texas is living up to its potential this year, and we know that we can do that. The director of athletics in years past, DeLoss Dodds, and Chris Polonsky has always preached the fact that we should be a top 10 team. And you're going to have ebb and flows during those times, but right now we're living and breathing the potential we have.
Chris, Greg Abbott signed Senate Bill 1385 yesterday, which keeps Texas from falling behind other states and allowing college athletes to profit off of name, image, and likeness. And that, of course, goes into effect on July 1st, which is big because that's the earliest other states are enacting such a law. It's not a stretch to say that this sort of legislation might put more distance between the haves and have-nots in college sports. We here at Texas, because of who we are and the conference that we're in, we are a part of the former. Do you think this will eventually lead to a more distinct line being drawn between the Power Five conferences and the Group of Five, specifically in college football, that whittles the teams down that are eligible for the expanded college football playoff down to those Power Five schools?
I don't think so, but what it does, it gives the schools the size and scope and an opportunity to display what the Longhorn Nation is and means. When you have over 600,000 living alumni, it's just the breadth and scope are there. But remember, you also have scholarship limitations. In football, each school is only allowed to have 25 scholarships per year, right? Or up to 85 total on the limit. So when you think about signing 25 kids, there's a tremendous amount of talent all over the country. And this name, image, and likeness bill is predicated on your own individual name, image, and likeness, not the University of Texas. It's not going to be Chris Del Conte at the University of Texas. It's going to be just Chris Del Conte. And what's that value worth? And I think the reality is talent comes from all walks of life in this country. If you think about the old TV show, America's Got Talent, you never know where someone's going to crop up and capture the hearts and minds of our nation. So it's a great thing for the University of Texas, but I wouldn't just quite yet say it's going to create this big catechism between one the have and have-nots.
I'm curious. You've obviously watched a lot of college sports in your life. Who is your favorite college athlete of all time that you'd love to go back and maybe pay a little extra scratch for their autograph? And why did you like watching him or her play so much?
You know, it's funny. I grew up in a children's home in Taos, New Mexico. So college athletics was really not my dream. I didn't have this idea. I think the first time I ever saw a college game might have been 1983 when it was Houston played NC State in New Mexico. And I remember thinking, oh, the Fight Slama Jamma, but didn't even think anything about college sports. I was at that time a pro player. I was a big fan of Roger the Dodger, the Dallas Cowboys, you know, the Doomsday defense, Too Tall Jones. That was my idol. I was not really looking at colleges until I got an opportunity to get a college scholarship. So I was really not – I kind of missed the boat of what college athletics was as a youth.
Most of us are excited at the prospect of the college football playoff expanding to 12 teams. It looks like that is really close to happening and going into effect in 2023. Do you think 12 is the best number to expand it to?
You know, it's interesting. I haven't got all – I'm just like you all. There still have a lot of work to be done. I just kind of gathered the information that these are just recommendations. We'll see once the board of directors convene next week. But I understand the concept of going to 12. I'm still a big fan of the Bulls and what they provide young people in terms of this great experience. But I do feel and understand that there's this want and need for expansion. But once we get more detail from our board of directors, this is just a recommendation from our working group. So we have a little work to do. And I'm really not too sure if it'll begin the 23 season. They're talking about the TV contract doesn't still run until 26. And we've already assigned the championship games for the next 2 years. So I think people are making a lot of assumptions early. We have a lot of work to do before anything is concrete.
If you had your say, would you go 12? Would you go 8? Would you maybe go 16?
You know what? It's interesting. When I worked at 1AA years ago, which is now the FBS, and I was working at 1AA. I still call it 1AA, by the way. I understood the 16-game playoff. I went from Washington State to Cal Poly. And I love the idea of, you know, at the time, Washington State going to a Rose Bowl, or I'm working in San Luis Obispo, and you get a chance to go to a playoff. And at that time, 16 worked. Now they're up to, it went from 8 to 16. Now they're at 24. So I see the benefits of leaving off 4, and I see the benefits of 6. I see the benefits of 8, and I see the benefits of 12. You know, the devil's in the detail, and we still got a lot of work to do, so I don't really have a horse in the race right now until I see all the information put forth.
If it is 12 and it does happen in 2023, is it reasonable to expect Steve Sarkisian to have his Longhorn team in that very first expanded playoff?
Well, I think the reasonable expectations you saw this year is that we have to live up to our own expectations that are the University of Texas. And that's why it says the winning tradition shall not be entrusted to the timid or the weak. I will never put a time frame on a coach of when he should or shouldn't, because wearing the burnt orange and white is not for the faint of heart. But I know Steve is prepared for the job. I know that our student athletes that we have coming in, the current students we have here, embrace the challenge of representing the University of Texas. And that's why we come here to ride Bevo. There's nothing else like it.
I am a big fan of the expanded playoff because I think, if nothing else, it will allow teams to schedule a second tough non-conference opponent. Now, Chris, I'm not going to ask you about whether you want to see Texas and A&M rekindle what had been a thing more than a decade ago now. You're already on the record as being for this, but there's some reluctance on the Aggie side of things. Starting in 2028, both schools have corresponding openings on the calendar. Because sometimes you have to allow some concessions to make things happen, would you be willing to allow A&M to host that very first game in order to get one of the top rivalries in the sport going again?
Well, you know, I don't know what I have in 28, because I know we have Alabama right now next year, home and home. Then we go Michigan, Ohio State, Georgia, Florida. So I'm pretty sure I'm booked in 28, 29 in terms of already having one of those opponents there. But, you know, when you look at when we added these teams, we wanted to make sure that we had a quality home opponent. I'm sure everyone would love to have play a rival game, because those games mean so much to us. But, you know, for us, the crazy thing is our rival game is actually played in the Cotton Bowl. So we'd like to have a really, truly meaningful game at home every year and every other year if possible. But, yeah, in 28-29, I don't know my schedule. I don't remember the call. I recall my schedule right off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure we have Georgia at that time.
I think 32 is the first year that neither team has another Power 5 opponent schedule. Would you be willing to allow A&M to host that first game if you were to schedule a home-and-home?
Yeah, listen here. Anytime you can get working with who you can get. I know the last time we played the game, we were at College Station. You know, you would say, hey, well, they got to come back to Austin. My point is, we are trying to make sure that the game gets played at some point in time. And that's at this point in time, I'm focused on what we have now. But if it took whatever it took to make sure that we have opportunities to play A&M, those are important to me because college athletics is important to me in terms of rivalries. It's just like Oklahoma playing Nebraska this year. That's great for college athletics. It's great for the rivalry. It's great for everybody, you know. But, you know, as we're still got a lot of work to do, we got a cooler heads have to prevail. I was not here when all those things went down. But I do appreciate the rivalry. I do appreciate the history of the game. I do appreciate the pomp and circumstance of the game. And when both of them are tied to fight songs, they're tied to mascots, they're tied to 90 miles being apart, those are things that make college athletics special. Across the board, and I am glad to see that Nebraska is playing Oklahoma this year as well, because those are worthy games that people in our country love to hear and watch.
All right, last question, Chris. I will never not marvel at your ability to handle any question that a Longhorn fan has for you with such grace and poise, regardless of how stupid the question is. Now, having said that, there are things that I've seen you answer time and time again on Twitter that I know have to get at least a little bit old. If there is one question that you would be okay with never having to answer again from the realm of Longhorn fans, what would it be?
You know, until I see the question in front of me, I couldn't tell you just because you put me on the spot. But I'll say this. This is what I love about college athletics. Right? I take the job seriously of supporting our student athletes and our coaches. And who allows us to be successful is our donors and our season ticket holders. And that's part of the job is make sure you have a balancing act of both. The greatest year that we're having this year athletically, it's our coaches and our student athletes have done a wonderful job. And we also had a trying year across the board with COVID and civil unrest and all the things we've had to deal with. And one thing that I'm really proud of is that the nation together is stuck together. That's part of my job is, as Daryl Royal said, once the BBs are out of the box, it's hard to get them back in. And my job is to continue to pick up each BB one at a time. And whatever, if that's a mundane question or a question of major significance, I'll make sure that we answer, that we follow through in our word because we're trying to make sure that all the BBs are back in the box. They are. It's a reckoning here at the 40 acres.
Is the question about why the uniforms aren't burnt orange enough at least close to that point?
That might be one. You know, we've been fighting that one forever. I actually went to Nike, brought every single uniform we've ever had and said variations. It's funny, once, like the old mesh that Ricky wore, it's actually same color, but then when it gets sweaty, it turns a little bit different color. And then they say, well, Nike did this. And it depends on what PMS color, what material you put it on. On paint, it's different than material. It is just crazy. But we know that we're burnt orange and white. We're doing our damnedest to get it right. And we are right majority of the time. But, you know, back in the day, the old helmet sticker is actually not burnt orange. It was a little bit darker brown. And that's the color I remember Earl Campbell wearing, in the pictures and stuff. Man, Earl wore that song. So, I mean, that color. So we're working on it, but we're never going to satisfy everybody.
Well, and it also matters if you're in person or in person at a distance or watching on television as well. There literally is no way to actually get the proper shade of burnt orange for everybody watching.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Crazy enough, too, is the lighting. You know, we have all these great people now doing all the, the graphic work and all that stuff. They put all this different lighting, and the uniforms actually look different under different lighting as they're trying to. We had a kid uniform the other day and a helmet the other day that looked like, boy, that's not the helmet I know. Well, I go down and see it, and it's burnt orange, but when they're under the certain lighting and how they're trying to make it interesting for recruiting graphic designers, it makes it look a little bit different, and people go, well, that's not the right color. So if you're coming to my office, I'll show you every uniform you've ever had, and you can see the difference and say, okay, I see what once was and what material changes, but they're all relatively in the family.
Well, and I can also rest easy in knowing that you'll never go full Aggie with the uniforms, and that is try to create a glow-in-the-dark uniform that you have to wear in the daytime, like what happened with A&M a couple years ago.
You know, what's interesting is I always tell everyone, that they say, well, why would you change uniform color? I say, what's the first color God sees when he wakes up in the morning? Burnt orange. What's the last color he sees when he goes to bed at night? Burnt orange. The reason you don't mess with perfection. We're burnt orange and white, two great colors. That's who we are. And if you want to, you don't want to candy up perfection. But when you don't have the tradition, you don't have the pomp and circumstance that is the University of Texas, you have to do things to become relevant. We don't need to do things to become wrong with our uniforms. And part of that is having young kids embrace who we are. And as uniforms are being changed to flash, we always revert back to, this is the University of Texas. These are our colors. And this is our history. And having that lineage from Bijan to Ricky to Earl to Street, all the way back to our legendary Longhorns, they all wore the exact same color. And that tells you where you can tie your history to. Spectacular.
Damn straight. He is the University of Texas Athletics Director, Chris Del Conte. Chris, thank you so much for the time today. And root him on to another championship in Omaha over these next couple of weeks, okay?
Yes, sir. I appreciate you. Sorry I was late.
No problem. There you go, CDC. Thank you very much for being patient with us with our interview with CDC. Coming up on the other side, Survivor Man Les Stroud joins the program for a 2-segment conversation. You're listening to Shirts and Skins, minus Chad Hastings today and all week long right here on The Horn. Back here on Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. No Chad Hastings today or this week. He is on vacation in the Houston area. We wish him the best, and the show must go on. I want to thank CDC for joining me last segment. If you missed that conversation but still want to give it a listen, you can do so at hornfm.com. Let's go back to the Vaqueros hotline now to welcome Les Stroud to the show. Les is a survival expert, filmmaker, author, and musician who's best known as the sole force behind the Survivor Man TV series. His newest book is titled Wild Outside, Around the World with Survivor Man. Les, thank you for the time today. How you doing?
I'm doing good. It's beautiful here right now, so I'm good.
Great. So this book was made as a sort of inspirational, informative guide for kids who are interested in adventurous exploring. You started filming and showing yourself surviving in remote locations around the world after years of training in survival, adventure, and filmmaking. Where did your training begin as a kid, even if you may not have realized it at the time?
Oh, well, I mean, I was a child of the 70s, so my training, it's not very glamorous, but it definitely was effective, and that was through television. I was a very big fan of Jacques Cousteau, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, Tarzan movies. These shows and films really kind of lit the fire in me in terms of wanting to have adventure in the wilderness, adventure in jungles, adventure on mountains and in the oceans. So yeah, that's really where it started. I didn't come from an adventurous family. I didn't have access to much of that. There wasn't really even that much going on at the time. So it was really out of reach for me as a kid. With the exception of my fascination, which led me into my own backyard and local parks, that sort of thing. And that is, that's where I found my adventure in those days, was going to the local ravine.
So in your mind, surviving an adventure, it comes down to 4 different elements, which you break down in this book: preparing, observing, reacting, and also adapting. As far as the preparation is concerned, that does include a number of different things, like researching the area, gathering proper supplies and tools, and seeking out local survival experts in that new place. But Les, a lot of people claim to be experts. Is there any one question that you ask to truly test how knowledgeable that person is about the area?
Yeah, and that's a good point, and it's a tricky point, is determining who the real wonderful, intelligent and experienced instructors are, and who isn't if they're just doing it as a business. To be honest with you, that problem didn't used to exist. Back in the day, so to speak, those types of instructors were there making very little money, but they were there because of their passion. When it became popular, you know, people thought they could make money doing it. You do start to get a lot of people with inexperience sort of jumping on the bandwagon. You used to get that even in kids camping. You know, you get people who would be, you know, 21 years of age, and they'd be thinking that they can lead trips with, you know, 18 students, and the issues and the things that can go on. I mean, you can lose life that way. Things can get turned very bad very quickly. But to answer your question, it is a little tricky. You want to research your instructors. I'm going to suggest that people that have a bit more experience in life are more likely to have had enough years doing adventures to get a lot of adventures and trips under their belt. You can say, well, look at, you know, so-and-so, I mean, they did kids camp all the way growing up, and then they guided kids trips, and they're only 23, but they're really experienced. And that may be the case. Or maybe people like that, but you want someone who's really a lifer. I like the people who are lifers in this stuff. They teach it, they love it, they share it, you know, and they would, whether it was a business or not. And then to be a little more specific though, I will just a tangent with an anecdotal reference is to say that when I would seek out specifically survival instructors, so now I'm not speaking just adventure, but specifically or all-encompassing adventure, I'm speaking specifically survival. I found that the last skill that most survival instructors learn tends to be wild edible plants. It's really strange. It's the last thing, and it's because the other skills are so exciting and dramatic, you know, fire starting and shelter building and all these different, you know, skills that, whether it's bushcrafting, primitive skills or survival skills. And it seems to me that that's always the last one. And so if I found somebody who was well-versed in wild edible plants and they taught survival skills, I made my own assumption that, okay, they went all the way through to wild edible plants. They're probably going to be good. That's what I used as my barometer or my filter, if you will, to figure out who can help me when I go down to some place like the jungle and I need to learn from them. I check and see what their edible plant knowledge is.
Makes a lot of sense. Does anything properly prepare you to run from a male moose that's trying to make you his prison girlfriend?
Nothing prepares you for that. That's the only time in all of my adventures that I've had where I actually would use the word scared, because I was scared up top of that tree. That was a big beast down there, full of a lot of anger. What can prepare you for that? Not much. Maybe knowledge, knowing that these things are possible and knowing how to deflect them or stay out of their way. That was. And what got me in trouble that day? I got cocky. That's what got me in trouble. It's what gets everybody in trouble. You get a little too confident, you know, and you forget to check all the boxes.
That's interesting, because in part three, where you talk about reacting, I would have assumed that that would be the most scared that you were when you're talking about the eye of the jaguar. One of the first places that you went when starting out as Survivor Man was the Amazonian rainforest, and you encountered a jaguar 6 or 7 days into this adventure. Why is this creature so scary, generally speaking, and how did you react to that situation?
So why is the jaguar so scary?
Yes.
Well, I don't think it is, except for the ambiance of big cats. You know, big cats are powerful beasts. And I think if you look biologically at what's out there, big canines, bears, for example, with the exception of the polar bear, you know, they have very, very, if any, interest in us at all. But big cats, you know, I mean, tigers do eat humans in India. I did a Survivor Man episode where I was, you know, surviving in a spot where a big tigress had, and she had cubs. She'd already killed 22 people that year. So big cats have a bit of an ambiance of spook to them, right? You know, even in literature and lore, just the big cat can be scary. Those are big claws, you know, their hunting techniques. I wasn't actually all that, you know, but just the same, not to contradict myself, but I wasn't really afraid of the jaguar. I just knew that, okay, I need to deal with this quickly by getting out of its territory. That's the thing to remember too, eh? Whenever you're out there, you're always in their territory. They're not in yours. they're not coming upon you by accident in their course of actions. You're coming upon them by accident. You're trespassing. And so you have to remember that. You have to give them their space, their berth, their allowance, that it's their place, not yours.
For people listening right now, is there a good resource that you like to utilize, and this could be for kids or adults for that matter, to really learn the wildlife that lives in their area?
Oh, there's so much now. I mean, certainly online is wonderful. Online is very, very helpful. The local organizations are great. There's always going to be local outers clubs, local birders, local wildlife federation. They always exist. River keepers. You know, if you saw the group and it's like river keeper of a certain river, you know they're going to know about nature, about wildlife too, not just the river, because it's what we do. We don't just like birds. We like birds and the bees, you know, sort of thing. So local organizations is a great way to, and they're easy to source now online. It's really to find them. You know, you look for those pamphlets that are at the REI store, the outdoor store. Go there. There's always pamphlets and things there because there's hikes being led. As I say, birding associations will lead birder hikes. Oh, you know, another place, a great place is local colleges. Often local colleges have those adult learning classes, after work classes, and you will find classes there on things like animal tracking.
Hmm.
You know, so just that kind of research. And that's how I got into, you know, when I moved away from music and got into survival, I found a little tiny course in a local college, and that set me on my path. It was about wilderness survival, so.
When discussing the importance of observing, you shared an anecdote from 7 warm and sunny days that you spent on the Cook Islands in the South Pacific Ocean. What lesson did you learn from observing Christmas snails?
Yeah, that was pretty fun, actually. It was the strangest thing I think I'd ever seen. You know, you're sitting there and you're like, what is that moving on all that shrubbery all around? Every shrub on the island had something moving on it. And you go in and you look closer and there's all these snails slithering their way up to the top of these shrubs. And then I noticed that they always did it just before sunset. And then, you know, and so this was odd, first of all, snails doing something like that. It's not that they don't climb on plants, they do, but this was crazy because I'm talking thousands of them all at the same time. Creepy, if you will, you know? And then I want to tackle your question. That's observation, right? Observing what's going on around you. I already had a knowledge base from research of what should look normal. And my eyes picked up something that did not look normal. And that's when you start to really observe and pay attention. Of course, it ended up being that they had over hundreds of years, or at least since the time of Captain Cook's rats, that's how they got on that island, was from shipping. Exploration, Captain Cook's exploration, the snails had learned that if they go up to the tops of these shrubs, the rats can't eat them. Simple as that. Real simple answer. And you'd see the rats trying to jump up at them, but they were just out of reach. And the shrubs were too spindly for the rats to climb up. So, you know, it was a pretty ingenious way of staying alive.
If I'm not mistaken, you were staying on the beach as this was going on. Were the rats a threat to you at all?
No. In fact, they were more of an annoyance to me because they were running past. At some point, if I would fall asleep, they'd run and they'd jump over my legs. You know, I know that freaks everybody out, but they didn't care about me. There was no disease I needed to worry about. They were just, you know, rats have a creep factor, I suppose, but no threat to me.
More than 40,000 people need to be found through search and rescue missions in the United States each year. What are some of the most important things for people to do when lost in the wild to help with them being located?
Unfortunately, the first part of the answer is what they're supposed to do before they go out in the wild. That's the big thing, is go out, letting people know where you're going, how long you're going to be, who you're with, when you expect to come back. And make sure that you have to notify them when you come back. So I did that. You know what? Just last week, I did an extra long trek with some heavy weight on my back because I'm doing some training for some search and rescue missions. And I actually sent a text to a buddy. I said, hey, I'm going up here, then I'm going there, and I've never gone there before, and I'm carrying 45 pounds. I'm just letting you know that if I send you a ping through my cell phone that I'm in trouble, I'm not joking. And my buddy is serious enough. He went, okay, let me make sure you tell me when you're up. So just doing that is huge, you know. But also the communication devices, recognizing that your phone may not work, but your texting might, you know, you can get a ping out there, is important. And it's all, you know, nowadays, I hate to say it, well, I'm a search and rescue technician, and the reality is I shouldn't be needed anymore, because there's so much great technology now that what should only ever be needed would be maybe be rescue because of injury. But searching should actually at this point be out of the game, because there is so much great technology from your cell phones and GPS devices. I mean, heck, I've got a GPS collar on my dog that works with a satellite. Now, all of these things can fail. All of their batteries can die. All of these things can be lost. That's true. So search and rescue is still needed. But that's a big thing. Know all of this new technology. Have fun with it. Geek out on it and use it, because it's easier for us as search and rescue technicians to go and rescue somebody when we know where they are than when we're still looking for them.
If all the technology fails, are there any handy things that can either be found on a person or in nature that can help out too?
You know, the nature thing, I'm going to say, sure, yeah, but that takes a lot of skill and a lot of practice to know those types of things. I think what I'd like to answer you with is to say this is, look, one thing you want to do when you're in that situation and everything's failing on you is don't put yourself in deeper trouble. Don't keep pushing forward. A lot of people die because they keep pushing forward. Now, I get it. You might be 30 miles out when your car quits on you on an old dirt road because you thought you were going to go fishing or hunting in some back area. But the thing is, you know what those 30 miles are all about. And assuming you can walk, I'm always a big supporter of go back the way you can. You know what's facing you behind you. Too many people have perished because they've thought, if I just go forward, I'm pretty sure I can go over that hill and there'll be another road. But it's always, yeah, you're pretty sure, but do you know? And people have died that way. So in the woods, I mean, if you're really down that deep in it, you know, then you have to use your ingenuity. You have to look and say, everything is something I can use here. I need a sleeping bag for tonight because I'm stuck here. It's going to get dark. I need to sleep. And I happen to be in a place that's just littered with oak leaves. Okay, make a big pile and climb in the middle. And you're now inside a sleeping bag that's actually way warmer than you might think. So, yeah, there are lots of things that can help you in nature. But, you know, you gotta do a little bit of pre-trip training and research to know.
He is Les Stroud, a.k.a. Survivor Man. Coming up, we continue our conversation on his book, Wild Outside, Around the World with Survivor Man. You're listening to Shirts and Skins, minus Chad Hastings today on The Horn. One more segment here on Shirts and Skins. I'm Trey Elling. Chad Hastings is on vacation this week. We go back to the Vaqueros Hotline now to continue our chat with Survivor Man Les Stroud about his new book, Wild Outside, Around the World with Survivor Man. Les, the fourth part of this book on surviving an adventure is to adapt. What does adaptation in the wild mean to you?
Accepting your circumstances, for one. You know, the panic thing is really dangerous. And a lot of times people, that's the first thing we do is we panic. And so actually, what's the first thing you should do in a survival situation or a lost situation? Don't panic. The first thing you should do is calm down. And then you want to, what I call them are the survivor man's zones of assessment, where you need to make a proactive decision. You can't make a proactive decision without a knowledge base. You need information. So let's calm down, take an E, as they say in sports. Let's get the information. And what is that? That's three zones of assessment. First thing is your body. What's on you? What are you wearing? I got a chocolate bar in my pocket, and I'm actually dressed really warm. And I got a small backpack on me, and it's got some water. Okay. Zone of assessment number two is what's close at hand. Well, the canoe's gone. It went downstream, and there's a paddle left here. Okay, I got a paddle. That's not going to do much to me. But I'm with another person, so there's actually two of us. They've done their zone of assessment, and we've got one pack that didn't dump. And what's in that pack? Oh, the tent's in that pack. Great. Now there's no sleeping bags, but the tent's there and a bit more food. Okay. Zone of assessment number three, what's further afield? Well, do you remember that a mile back we passed a cabin? Oh yeah, there is a cabin. Just, you know, can we get to it along the shoreway? Or if we walk due east, no matter what, we have to hit Highway 11. Oh yeah, that's right. How far is it? It can't be more than a mile. We know that from our maps that we lost. Okay. So that, put that all together. I got a chocolate bar. I'm dressed well. I got a buddy. We've got a tent. And we know there's a cabin and we can walk to the highway. All of that together. Now you go, okay, we have knowledge. Let's make a decision. And that all took 60 seconds. That's adapting.
You had to adapt when eating a couple of different grubs in different parts of the world. They looked very similar, but the flavors couldn't be any more different. One was in the Aussie outback, and the other was on an island in Sumatra, Indonesia. What was the difference in flavor between those two grubs?
Night and day. Yeah, the first one in Australia kind of misled me, because I have to say, on the odd occasion, creepy crawlies are pretty tasty. That grub tasted fantastic. It was roasted and it tasted like, imagine a crispy pork rind with Thai peanut paste on the inside. It was pretty good.
My mouth is watering right now at that.
I know. And even scorpions, when they're roasted, taste like the little burnt ends of chicken wings. But the grub that I had in Sumatra, which looked almost exactly like the grub in Australia, that tasted like if you took milk and put it in a plastic bag and left it out in the hot sun for 2 weeks and then just bit into the plastic bag. That's what that one tasted like. So lots of paradoxes in nature, and things that look beautiful that can kill you, things that look drab that you can eat, things that look drab that can kill you, things that look beautiful that you can eat. It's just, it's kind of the wonderful part of it.
What advice do you have for kiddos and adults who are trying maybe an unfamiliar food?
Get hungry first. You know what? After 4 days of being really hungry, everything starts to look and taste good.
You spent some time on a frozen lake during the Ontario, Canada winter. Why are extremely cold temperatures the toughest for you to survive?
Because you can't stop surviving. There's no forgiveness time. You've put me in a harsh area, but tell me that it's going to be 75 degrees Fahrenheit and it's sunny. I got forgiveness time. I can sit around and think this through. You know, you put me in a beautiful, awesome place to be, but it's below freezing. I have no forgiveness time. I'm going to become hypothermic if I don't do something to get warm and stay warm. So cold, you know, people might want to argue hot. You know, extremes of any kind are rough, and super hot in the Kalahari Desert is super hot. I get that. But even there, I could hide in in a little bit of shade. But when it's cold, you just can't stop. And that's why I personally, for me, feel that anytime it's really cold, that's the toughest survival there is.
So how did you keep yourself warm overnight when the temperatures dipped as low as negative 50 degrees Fahrenheit? We got single digits here in Austin last week, and people were on the verge of something bad.
Yeah, man, everything you can. But, you know, there's a few little tricks out there. I'm a fan of turning a solid object like rocks into hot water bottles. Sorry, I didn't realize you're in Austin, and I did some news talks when the whole thing was going on. Keeping warm at night like that, when it's that cold, there are some tricks. Now, obviously, you need to have heat. You need to be able to make things hot, such as water, hot water bottles. But, you know, I remember with my kids when we would go camping, I would heat up, you know, I'd boil some water and heat up some water, and I'd pour it into a Nalgene, a hard Nalgene container. And I'd put that in their sleeping bag down by their feet, and it would warm them right up. You know, but it's not comfortable. You don't even have to touch it. It's there in the bag, and it's hot. You know, so you can do that with rocks in the survival situation in the wilderness. You heat up rocks, not river stones, but rocks. And river stones keep microscopic. There's microscopic water in river stones, and they can explode on you. But you heat up regular rocks, and to the point where they're hot, but you can touch them. Put those in your sleeping bag, and it might be a rock, but you end up snuggling it all night long. It's really an amazing trick, actually. And then another trick, another one I didn't mention in that thing was I do a thing when I'm in a survival situation in cold, which is horrible. I hate it. I muscle group by muscle group, slowly, I squeeze and flex and release. Squeeze. So I'll start with my toes and my feet and my calves and my quads and my buttocks and my stomach and my chest and my arms and my neck. And then I'll go back down again. All of that muscle contracting and releasing starts to get the blood flowing. You really, you can warm up just lying still. The last trick I do is I get up and I do jumping jacks or push-ups. And if you're able, that's a great way. Oh, one quick little trick, and I actually gave it when I was talking to people in Texas, was this. If you have some food, if you have fat food, like cheese, like a one-inch block square of cheddar cheese, eat that right as you're going to bed. In bed, if you want. Just eat it right as you're going to bed. That fat will burn in your stomach all night long and keep you remarkably warm.
Huh. Well, I'd be remiss to ask you for some hot weather tips, considering we are in Texas and we deal with 100-degree heat far more often than we do single-digit temperatures. So what is your advice for really hot conditions?
Well, one of the things, the main thing, of course, obviously, is dehydration. That's huge. And I know you know that, especially being in Texas. I mean, dehydration is, it's a killer. And I think little side trick is this, is people don't realize that one of the greatest, I say greatest, but I guess one of the worst ways that you can become dehydrated, or at least the most effective ways to become dehydrated, is through the wind, convection. The wind sucks the moisture right out of your skin. It's very effective at sucking that moisture right out of you. And so even when it's really hot, if you actually wear a light protective shirt, you help to stop that convection drying. And and you know, if you're, a lot of people want, we might just want to go shirtless. Oh, it's hot, I'm just going to take my shirt off. But you're going to dehydrate faster with your shirt off.
And you're also possibly going to end up sunburned too, which just adds a whole other level of challenge, right?
Right. But some people might be okay with the sun, or they slather up a sunblock and or whatever. But I'm saying that wind convection, that breeze sucks the moisture right out of you.
Good to know. You admit growing up that you idolized Jacques Cousteau and Tarzan the Ape Man. Do you feel like you've grown up to be a pretty good blend of those two guys?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, Trey, really, if you think about it, what is Survivor Man if not a hybrid of Jacques Cousteau and Tarzan?
I mean,
that was my childhood dream, and I don't know how it ended up happening, but it did. Many years later, but it did. Yes, it is the hybrid. I think that's by design, at least subconscious design.
And final question, Les. We had Max Brooks on the show about a year ago. He was planning on being in town for South by Southwest. Of course, COVID ruined all of our plans in 2020. He said the greatest validation that he received with his book Devolution, which was a great book, was getting the thumbs up from you that it was authentic. So I have to ask you, as somebody who takes a lot of pride in the interviews that I conduct with authors, do I get the thumbs up for this conversation?
You do, because you've asked me at least two questions that I've never got before, and that's always important to me. And also, you didn't ask me about Bigfoot, so big kudos there. I will add, since you brought up Max Brooks, that I will have coming out soon on American Public Television is a new special called Surviving Disasters with Les Stroud. I actually interview Max for that special, 90-minute special, and it's all about how to deal with natural disasters, just like you went through, just like the pandemic, just like Hurricane Michael, all of them. And it'll be coming out in June, and it speaks directly to everybody, especially where you guys live.
And where can people see that, Les?
American Public Television, so a PBS station near you.
Les Stroud is a survival expert, filmmaker, author, and musician who's best known as the sole force behind the Survivor Man TV series. His new book is called Wild Outside, Around the World with Survivor Man. Les, thank you for the time today, and thank you for this book.
Okay, thanks, man.
If you joined in partway through this conversation and want to hear the whole thing, you can do so at booksonpod.com. Since we're handing out thank yous, I'd like to go ahead and show some appreciation to Bucky Godbolt for hanging out with me from 12 to 2 today. Also, Chris Del Conte joined the show at 2 o'clock. You can hear that interview at hornfm.com. Thanks to Isaiah Collier, for producing today. And thanks to you for listening. Join us tomorrow as my co-hosts are Zay from 12 to 1, Jeff Ward from 1 to 2, and I'm hosting an Austin Food and Restaurant Roundtable with the Statesman's Matthew Odom and Jesse Cape of the Austin Chronicle from 2 to 3. Up next is the Triple Option with RBKD. For Chad Hastings, I'm Trey Elling. Have yourselves a superb afternoon and hook 'em.